Thanks, Peter. So this is intended to be completely different from everything else this week. And in particular, this is meant to be completely informal. So please ask questions at any point, during this talk. Let's try to get a discussion going. It says there's 27 slides. I'm only going to show maybe half that number. So this is actually a talk I gave a couple of weeks ago, as you'll see at JP Morgan. In general, I would say this whole area of high performance computing on GPUs is something that I got into because my background is in doing high performance computing for CFD, computational fluid dynamics, in the past. None of my finance applications are, in a sense, demanding enough that I need to do this for my own Monte Carlo research that I'll be talking about tomorrow. So all of the stuff I'm going to be talking about tomorrow morning, I do in MATLAB. But for the banks who are just doing vast numbers of simulations, calculations, and have huge computer rooms with racks and racks of PCs, this GPU business really is important to them. So generally, when I'm talking about GPUs for finance, I'm doing things like visiting one of the banks and giving an internal talk to them, rather than talking at any sort of academic settings. So I really don't know how much assume that you know about these things. So this is my starting slide, just to explain the way these things are set up. That typically you have a workstation or you have a regular server. And what you have is a motherboard, which you have a couple of quad core Xeons sitting on the motherboard, and that big fat line is meant to signify that there's a very high bandwidth interconnect between the CPUs. And then you've got some amount of system memory on the motherboard, and that's quite a thin connection, so relatively low bandwidth. And then over here, we have a graphics card that sits in the chassis, connected by a PCI Express bus. And roughly speaking, this connection between the graphics card and the motherboard is of similar bandwidth, maybe a bit less, but not too much less, than the connection between the motherboard out to the main system memory. Okay. And then this is meant to be one of our GPUs, our graphics chips, just massively multi-core. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yes.
I'm not a computer science department, so a lot of these acronyms are going
to Okay. It's simply the name of the bus that connects the graphics card to okay. It's the interconnect, the memory, the data connection between the graphics card and PCI Express is a particular type of hardware interface that's used to connect the graphics cards into the main system board. Yes, I'm sorry. There is a lot of technology, a lot of terminology, a lot of acronyms. No, graphics processing unit. Okay, so. So that's these graphics chips. And so this graphics card, I mean physically, it's a card that you plug in the back of the machine, and it connects into one of these slots that sits on the motherboard. And it has its own special graphics memory. So this G is again for graphics. So basically, it's a special high-speed memory that's on the graphics card, much higher performance than the regular memory in the main system, and a very high bandwidth connection. So, very high data rate. Because basically, there's no point in having something that can do lots and lots of computations if you can't feed the data in fast enough to sort of sustain that. Okay. So this gives really the motivation for why people are caring about using GPUs. That currently the current generation of Intel and AMD CPUs have up to 6 cores. So the latest ones that have just come out have 6 cores. Also, each of them has a little vector unit. SSE stands for streaming extensions, superscalar streaming extensions. I know, it's just an acronym. So basically, it's a little vector unit. And what that vector unit can do is it can add two vectors or multiply the elements of two vectors, and the vector length is either length 4 if it's single precision or length 2 if it's double precision. So it's small vectors. They were originally added into the CPUs for doing graphics applications on machines that didn't have a separate graphics chip. Okay, but these are going to become important in the future, so I'll say more about that. So 10 to 30 gigabytes a second data transfer rate between the CPU and the main system memory. I would say in practice it's more like the low end of that, so 10. The current generation of NVIDIA chips, a single chip has 240 cores, okay, compared to the 6 cores in the CPU. And they're actually arranged in groups of 8, so you have 30 groups of 8. And the current generation has at least 100 gigabytes a second data bandwidth between the GPU and the graphics memory, this special high-performance memory on the graphics card. Okay. So a single GPU using all of its cores, comparing that to writing a program that uses just a single core on the Xeon, I tend to reckon on a factor 50 to 100 times speed up. Okay. So each of these 240 cores, that's saying it's roughly on the order of half of an Intel core. Okay. And typically, if I'm comparing one GPU with a couple of quad-core Xeons, then a factor 10 is what I'm looking for in speed up. Okay. So the factor 10 savings in price performance and energy efficiency, both of those are important. Actually, the energy efficiency is becoming increasingly a concern. Yeah?
But even to do that, don't you have to do something to create a multi-threaded program to use two quad-core Xeons?
Oh, yes. And
if you just ran a regular program, you're going to use one little thing there.
And that is something I'll come back to. The fact that, increasingly, there is a lot of effort needed to write the code to exploit the GPUs. But increasingly, there's a lot of effort needed to write the code to fully exploit the CPUs. Life's getting tougher. The good news in a sense for everyone within this room is that at one level, you can do your academic research and not have to worry about this, because the individual calculations you need to do to develop your models, develop your methods, maybe aren't particularly computationally intensive. When it comes to the banks doing huge numbers of these simulations, for the quants who are having to develop the codes, this is becoming an issue. The programming complexity is something that they're having to face. And part of the computer science challenge within the universities ought to be what can be done at the computer science level to hide this complexity, to make it easier for the application developers. I would say that is becoming more and more part of the computer science research agenda, and particularly in the U.S., there's a lot of federal research money going into that. Just finishing the thought on energy efficiency. What I've been told in Canary Wharf in London, where the main banks are, they basically run out of electricity. If a bank wants to get more electrical supply to increase the number of machines it has, then tough. It simply isn't available. That any new generation capability coming on stream in the next few years is already committed to the 2012 Olympics. And so until the Olympics is over, there won't be any more electrical power delivered to Canary Wharf. Yeah. True. So what's happening is now I understand a number of the banks are building new data centers around the edge of London where they have the electrical supply. But to create a brand new data center is a major cost. You know, so what some of the banks are having to look at is, you know, the pros and cons of a brand new data center over here, or we put in the programming effort to rewrite our analytics to run on the GPUs. You know, so it's a trade-off. Right now the quants are resistant because of the amount of effort that's going to be on them, but this is where it comes down to sort of company CTOs making decisions about, you know, the way it's going to have to be. Yeah, just a comment as to, you know, how is it possible that NVIDIA has 240 cores and Intel has only 6? You know, it's not that Intel's stupid, it's just that Intel's made different architectural choices. Intel's aiming for the mass market, and the mass market are people doing word processing, email, running antivirus software, stuff like that. You know, the graphics chips are designed for people doing, well, primarily computer games, but actually doing graphics rendering is a naturally data parallel application that can very easily exploit lots of cores. You know, the cores that they have are extremely simple cores, so they cut out a lot of the sort of logical complexity. The Intel cores can do things like out of order execution. Well, what that means is that the compiler says, you know, this is the order in which you're going to perform operations to execute this code. On the Intel chip, the chip can on the fly decide to reorder the operations depending whether the data is ready to actually perform the calculation. And there's a huge amount of logical complexity involved in doing that, and that takes up a lot of the chip real estate. So the NVIDIA cores are just really, in a sense, really simple cores. Don't do anything clever, but they just manage to therefore squeeze lots more of them onto the real estate. There's a question, I mean, before I got into sort of putting any effort into this, you know, the question is this going to be a flash in the pan? You know, that maybe there's going to be this factor 10 benefit for GPUs for a couple of years, but then it's going to go away and the CPUs will catch up, okay? My belief is that that will not happen. My belief is that we will continue to see this 10-to-1 sort of difference between CPUs and GPUs for the foreseeable future. And foreseeable, in my terms, is sort of 5 years up towards 10 years. You know, beyond that, you just can't have any guesses, really. There are other companies producing GPUs. So IBM has something called the Cell Processor that they developed with Sony and Toshiba for the Sony PlayStation. IBM's actually now pulled the plug on this in terms of future development of Cell. It was too hard to program. They weren't making money out of it for this sort of high-performance computing area. So, you know, the chip's still being produced for the games market, but not for other purposes. AMD produces lots of GPUs, particularly in the regular games market. I would say they're probably ahead of NVIDIA currently, but they've chosen not to really fight in the HPC space. You know, the high-performance computing space. And Intel has an ongoing project called Larrabee to produce its own GPU. Larrabee's hit problems, and so the first generation Larrabee chip is now not going to be produced as a commercial product. They may still go to a second generation one in a couple of years' time. But anyway, you know, there is a lot of work going on in GPUs. Right now, NVIDIA is the main game in town. And in particular, the thing that's important with NVIDIA is they have this software environment called CUDA. And that's the big development, the fact that that's made it possible to program these chips relatively easily. There is also a new standard called OpenCL. This was pushed particularly by Apple. Apple became convinced that GPUs were a good thing and offered, you know, phenomenal possibilities, but they didn't want to get locked into having to buy chips from NVIDIA. So they pushed this new standard got AMD to agree to the standard so that they can basically continue to play off NVIDIA against AMD for future chip purchases. In terms of what's driving all this, why has it become possible to do programming on graphics chips? The initial thing that drove it is what's called games physics. Now, personally, I don't play any of these computer games, but you know, the idea of the games physics is, you know, if you're doing one of these racing games and you sort of drive your car into a brick wall, you know, the brick wall breaks up into individual bricks, and those in the game move under full 6 degree of freedom, you know, equations of physical motion. Those have to be simulated. You know, so there's more and more simulation required in the game's, you know, calculations, and the CPU doesn't have enough horsepower to do that. So more and more of this physics simulation, you know, simulation in quotes, because some of it's not very realistic, but more and more of that's being done on the graphics chip rather than on the CPU. So that I think is initially what really pushed NVIDIA to make these things much more usable, was to help the games developers. Another sort of application is streaming video. So again, this is a mass market application. The iPhone has a graphics chip in it which supports this OpenCL standard. So if you have streaming video coming to your iPhone, that's almost certainly using a video codec that's written using this OpenCL standard. Okay. But then NVIDIA is particularly interested in getting into this high-performance computing business. So, you know, increasingly companies like Cray are now developing supercomputers using NVIDIA's GPU chips as the main horsepower. You know, so, you know, the whole game is changing because of these GPUs. Okay. So why do I think the GPUs will stay ahead? Okay, so SIMD is single instruction multiple data. It basically means that the different cores within the NVIDIA chip are basically all doing the same thing at the same time but with different data. And so again, that cuts down the logical complexity of deciding what operations are to be performed, makes it possible to devote more and more of the real estate to actual floating point compute rather than figuring out what to do next. So as it says, you know, that architectural choice means much more of the chip real estate is devoted to actual compute. The way that Intel is responding to this, I think, is, you know, I talked about those SSE vectors, that they're currently of length 4 in single precision or 2 in double precision. Next year, there's a new Intel chip coming out where the vector lengths are twice as long. I think the chances are the vector lengths will double again in another 2 years. So basically, Intel's responding to the GPUs by having these increasingly long vector units within their cores, as well as going multi-core. But that means that if the programmers are going to extract that power, they're going to have to write code that, you know, uses those vector capabilities, you know, and that's probably going to be as much work doing that as I found it using the GPUs, you know, which is to say it's not a huge amount of work, but it is more. Okay. Yeah. They have both single precision and double precision. So the current generation, the double precision, worst case is a factor 8 slower than single precision. The next generation GPU that's shipping next month, it's just a 2-to-1 ratio between double and single. So, and the new chips also have 64-bit addressing, so they have the same addressable memory. The typical graphics card that you'd have in a sort of computer for doing games applications would have a gigabyte of graphics memory, but the ones that NVIDIA sells for high performance computing, they have 4 gigabytes of graphics memory on the graphics card. So I think you know, for the applications that I'm interested in, having 4 gig is, you know, enough memory on the graphics card. Yes, so the GPUs, you know, okay, so the question is why the move to GPUs when the bank's data centers have virtualization and you know, already have these vast sort of racks of PCs. I mean, the key thing is that the GPUs give you, you know, on the order of a factor 10 improvement in price performance and energy efficiency compared to these, you know, PC-based chips which the banks are using currently. You know, so it's just, you know, savings, you know, and large enough savings to justify the programming effort. I don't think it's raw speed because you know, most of the overnight, you know, runs are, you know, it's sort of a throughput issue of doing the overnight calculations, you know, the P&L calculations. So I think it's just an issue of costs for a given number of calculations to be performed. Let's skip through that. Okay, so what's going on currently within finance? The one who's done most in this is Bloomberg, and so, you know, this I think happened now 6 months ago, something of that order. So as it says, so 48 times 4, so roughly 200 GPUs, and you know what their press release said was that was replacing 2,000 CPUs. There's a, you know, from about a year ago, BNP Paribas was the first one that sort of publicly said that they'd gone into the production using the GPUs. Lots of banks, certainly in London, I believe it's the same in New York, have been doing proof of concept studies, you know, sort of testing out the technology. The IT groups within the banks have a sort of technology awareness function that sort of checks out all of this new hardware. My impression is that the IT groups like what they see with the hardware. They like, you know, the savings, you know, the energy savings, the cost savings. The quants are concerned about the programming effort and the fact that it's basically going to be dumped onto their laps to cope with that. And when I gave this talk two weeks ago at JP Morgan, both sides, both the IT people and the quants agreed with that statement. So I could see that there'd been some level of discussion or conflict between the two groups there previously before the meeting. You know, there are also lots of independent software vendors who are developing applications using CUDA. The one that's perhaps doing it best to what I'm aware of anyway is a company called SciComp that has a product called SciFinance and that uses GPUs. But I don't think their software is used by very many of the banks. I think there's one big bank in New York that uses SciFinance, but I forget which one. Ah, right. Would you like to comment on Are you using the your the GPU capability? Okay, but any reason why you're not using it, or? Okay, I'd be very curious to know. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Sure. It's a great way to go, you know. So I mean, this is very much the sort of direction of a lot of computer science research. It's the idea of what they call domain-specific high-level languages, which then, you know, lead to code generation onto different platforms at the low level. But okay, in terms of taking existing code, the problem is having a compiler or, you know, a processor which will take that and convert it. Those tools don't exist. Yeah. So right now I like the approach that SciFinance has taken of trying to separate out, you know, the problem specification from the sort of low level implementation details, and you know, that's a framework where, you know, the people who are using SciFinance, they just declare their models once, and then any new hardware that comes along in the future, you know, it's left to SciFinance to produce a new back end to produce it. You know, that seems like a very good approach, but the impression I get is that, you know, apart from one bank, you know, SciFinance hasn't been widely, you know, picked up. Generally, the tier ones seem to prefer to develop their own methods themselves. Generally, you know, C++. Yeah. So the way, you know, the programming environment for use on these NVIDIA chips is something called CUDA. It's essentially C++ extensions, and over time they're adding more and more C++ capabilities. So again, the current hardware has some fundamental restrictions which, amongst other things, mean that you can't have recursion, for example. The next generation hardware, they've removed all of the fundamental hardware restrictions which prevent C++ being implemented onto it. It will probably take, I would guess, 2 to 3 years before they complete all of the software developments to essentially support all of C++ on the GPU. But over time, they're adding in more and more C++ capability. But right now, it's basically, you know, C plus various extensions. At one level, it's kind of tedious. If anyone here has experience of MPI programming, then it's a bit like that. You have a bit of the code that runs on the CPU, on the main computer, a bit of the code that runs on the graphics card, and you have to write the code that manually sort of moves across data from one to the other, you know, that allocates memory on the graphics card. It's a bit tedious. It's not fundamentally difficult once you get used to it, but there is effort involved. For Monte Carlo applications, I'd say it's really pretty straightforward once you have a random number generator. And I've worked with a company called NAG that does mathematical libraries, and we've developed a random number generator, you know, to make available to people to try to simplify this whole issue of developing applications. Doing finite difference applications currently is significantly harder. I could go into details on that, but, you know, given the time, I probably won't. Again, the next generation chip, they basically, well, they've added in caches on the next generation chip, which didn't exist on the current generation. The consequence of having that is that you can write code in a more natural way, in a simpler way. And so today, finite difference is painful. Another couple of months on the finite difference side, I would say, will be pretty much as straightforward as the Monte Carlo side. Yeah.
So, are there restrictions on
No, no. If you have an MPI code, you can keep a lot of the MPI ideas and approach, but not the code. Yeah. Okay, so this is, you know, a sort of summary of my experience with it. So the random number generator that I developed is based on Pierre Lecuyer's multiple recursion generation. This is one that's in the Intel vector stats libraries. This is one of the standard random number generators. One of the difficulties of doing fair comparisons between different platforms is that you put in lots of effort on the GPU. Do you equally put in lots of programming effort to get the most out of the CPU? So the fairest thing to do is actually to compare against Intel's own library, because you assume they've done the best job they can. So, so 2.5 billion values a second on the GPU, 70 million a second per core on the Intel Xeon, and that's their programming. A LIBOR Monte Carlo test case, 100 times speed up compared to a single thread, a single core. Yeah. I mean, these are the numbers that Intel quotes on their webpage as being the performance of their random number generator. A three-factor PDE application, 50 times speed up compared to a single thread on a Xeon, 10 times speed up compared to using a couple of quad cores. So working out from that ratio, you're only getting a factor 5 speed up on the Xeons when you go from one thread to 8 threads. And that's because this is an application that's much more memory bandwidth limited rather than compute limited. Now, those results are all for single precision. My double precision experience with these has been, you know, factor 2 to 4 slower in double precision compared to single precision. But with the next generation chip, that'll come down to the factor 2. Okay, so a couple of issues there then. So on the random number generation, if I remember correctly, the period of this one is 2 to the 64 or 2 to the 96. The period of this one certainly doesn't depend on whether you're using single precision or double precision as the output. But basically, it's an integer-based generation of the uniform 0, 1, and then you do Box Muller or whatever to convert to the normals. My feeling on single precision for Monte Carlo is, the one time I would be nervous about using single precision is if you're doing the Greeks by bumping and you're using small bumps, then that exacerbates the machine round-off errors. That if you're doing the Greeks by either pathwise sensitivity or likelihood ratio method, then my feeling is single precision is perfectly sufficient. You know, compared to, you know, the errors with, you know, the uncertainty in the model parameters, the, you know, the Monte Carlo sampling error, the discretization error, I don't think single precision's an issue, but the bumping I think can be a problem. And likewise for finite difference, I'd be really surprised if, you know, if the errors from single precision were significant compared to you know, the errors from, you know, the uncertainty in the modeling parameters and the discretization errors. I don't know. I mean, I'm interested to, you know, do other people have views on that or? Right. Yes.
So then you might have to put in a lot of work, which is what my PhD student in Thailand is about, to reconfigure the flow of operations in the program to take advantage of the GPU, just to get back up to something like an 80 times speed up. Because if you just take literally the same algorithm and port it onto a GPU, it might speed up by a factor of only 3 or something, is what happened to us at first. So there,
yeah.
I don't know if the bad news is that maybe it'd be better just to use simple algorithms that fit well with the GPU, or if the good news is there's room for a lot of creativity in engineering efficiency techniques in simulation or maybe other applications that will be compatible with the GPU, to get the combined benefit of both of those things, the algorithmic efficiency and the hardware efficiency.
Yes, I mean, certainly one of the gotchas is this fact that you're essentially writing vector code. So, you know, the paths are being executed in groups of 32. So, you know, they've got this terminology where a warp is a group of 32 threads. So each of these warps has to be doing the same thing at the same time with all 32 threads. If they want to do conditional branching, so one thread wants to do the first part of an if, and another thread wants to do the second part, what effectively happens is they execute both parts, and then they just logically store the bit that's relevant to them. And so you lose efficiency if they have to execute different pieces of the code. So for example, I mean, a trivial example would be if you have a down-out barrier option where you might normally do a path calculation and just terminate the path if it dropped below the barrier. With vector computing, you basically wouldn't get any benefit from that. You know, it's best to just run all of the paths on to maturity, even if a few of them drop below the barrier. So, there are some slight gotchas like that. And sometimes you may have to be creative and change the way you do your implementation. You know, still stick with the same mathematics, but really rethink the way you do the programming in order to avoid this kind of problem. Now, I should also say I've only done very simple Monte Carlo examples. So, for example, I've not done Longstaff-Schwarz. That's on my to-do list. I really ought to. I haven't tried implementing a local vol surface. That's another thing I really ought to do. I find myself saying this again and again. At some point, I really must. I mean, local vol surface shouldn't be a problem, but there are some slight questions as to what's the most efficient way to do it. Longstaff-Schwarz, likewise, it shouldn't be a particular issue, but I'd like to do it and just make sure there aren't any gotchas. Yeah. I have no experience there. I mean, for very large dense linear algebra, there are packages being developed. So basically, the group who developed LAPACK currently have a project called Magma, which is sort of doing a next generation LAPACK for GPUs, and they've already got a fair number of capabilities in that. But it is important that you have essentially a massive level of parallelism. So not only does it have 240 cores, But typically you're running with, you know, anywhere up to 40 threads per core. So 10,000 threads. So you really do need a huge amount of data parallelism within your application to exploit that. You know, and so you do have to sort of look at your application to see, you know, do you have that much? So for some optimization applications, maybe you simply won't have that level. Now, what you could then do are things to think about. So I've got good results in 3D. In 2D, I only got good results if I went to ridiculously big grids, sort of 1,000 by 1,000. And so the answer there is, if you view this as a sort of throughput engine, and if what you care about are two-factor applications, then what you should be doing is not doing just one 2D application on the whole chip. You should be doing lots of 2D applications on the chip at the same time, maybe for different payoffs or whatever. Again, that's extra programming complexity to sort of organize that. But that's the sort of thing that you may have to think about doing in order to get the level of data parallelism so that there's enough work that can be done by the different threads. And you know, the number of threads is only going to go up. I mean, I've already said the next generation chip has 500 cores compared to the current generation 240. You know, chances are it'll double again in another couple of years. You know, I mean, Moore's law in terms of the number of transistors, the amount of circuitry that you get on the chip. Moore's law is continuing pretty remorselessly, and so the way that extra circuitry will be used is inevitably just more and more cores. The data bandwidth is one of the challenges for the future to keep that going.
Not understanding any of the physics, but what I think Paul and I heard from IBM, Intel, and others was one of the physics that's driving this is that you couldn't get the CPU speed to keep doubling. That's why
yes. Yes. Yeah, it hit a brick wall in terms of the clock frequencies. That the power consumption was just getting ridiculous, and so yes, they've actually backed off a little bit in clock speed and just gone massively multi-core. Yeah. Okay, let's skip through all of that stuff. So this is the new chip that's coming out. Apparently they're having troubles bringing this in under the sort of thermal budget, and so it was going to be 512 cores. It's now going to be 440 in order to keep the power consumption down, so they can get the cooling to work. And then so half the number of double precision cores and level 1 and level 2 cache, so much more like a conventional CPU in that respect, which is going to simplify the programming. AMD's got, I said this already, I think, that they've got really good GPUs, but not really for the high-end compute. They basically don't see the money in the high-performance computing community to justify their development effort, and so they've sort of elected not to compete with NVIDIA on the high end. And IBM's given up with the Cell program, and Intel is continuing with the Larry project, but it's not clear when, if anything, if ever, that chip will really come to fruition. So I think more interesting is to watch the mainstream CPUs with these AVX vectors. But CPUs are very much driven by sort of the mass market. And it seems to me that because of that, the CPUs are unlikely to have the high level of data bandwidth which the GPUs have. And so I think lack of memory bandwidth could be the Achilles heel for the CPUs. Now that's particularly relevant to finite difference applications. Monte Carlo applications maybe aren't so critically dependent on data bandwidth. So that may not be quite such a concern. But I do think the programming effort for exploiting these AVX vectors is likely to be as much as doing the GPU programming using, you know, this CUDA environment. What do we need? I mean, I think Oxford's typical in having lots of interest in doing this kind of GPU computing across a lot of different scientific areas. So, you know, when I talk to people in the banks, you know, the comment I make is, in 2 or 3 years' time, you know, the quants being hired, coming out of doing PhDs in theoretical physics, will have this kind of GPU programming experience. That's my belief. As it is, I've already had 2 or 3 headhunters so phoning up asking me whether I know people with CUDA and finance as expertise. You know, there are people out there wanting to hire and finding it hard to find people with the right skills. At least one of those headhunters was trying to get people for Bloomberg. I'm not sure about the others. And you know, we need more and more libraries that try to provide the capabilities of using these chips, but cut down on the level of programming effort required. Because life's getting more and more complicated for the poor programmer, and it would be nice to it would be nice to address that. I don't know how much confidence I have about that. I think, you know, the reality is you know, for the quants, life's getting harder, not easier, in terms of implementing the models. And I rather fear that's going to continue for a while. So, there's a whole bunch of websites here for anyone who wants to follow up. Or if you go to my main web page, then I've got a page on there with lots of GPU talks that I've given to, you know, various different places. No. More questions? Oh, I mean, Jim would be a much better person to talk on this than me, but I guess one observation that I have, coming from a background in CFD, in computational fluid dynamics, in the early days of CFD, you had lots of different CFD codes, each addressing one particular problem. And then over time, companies like Rolls-Royce developed, you know, one big massive corporate CFD code that basically addressed all of the company's needs across all of the product areas. And I guess I see that happening now within the banks. You know, I'm aware of, you know, Credit Suisse has a group, you know, GMAG, which is Global Methods and Analytics Group, where it's one group developing methods across the whole corporation and somehow trying to coordinate development efforts between London and New York and wherever else they have. So I get the sense that, you know, this is happening in multiple places where, you know, the companies are moving towards global methods, you know, one corporate engine. And in principle, having that one corporate engine means that you can then concentrate the effort on porting that engine onto, you know, things like GPUs. You know, whereas if you had lots and lots of different codes, porting all of them across to GPUs would be such an effort that it probably wouldn't happen. But Jim, do you want to say anything? But would you agree that there is this, so bringing together, you know, within organizations to have one central team increasingly?
I'm not the guy.
I
stayed away from all this stuff.
Okay.
I know that's what people are trying to get them to do, but whether they're actually achieving it.
I think one problem I see is this huge sort of schism between, you know, the quants and the IT people. That there just seems to be a big gap there, that the IT people have backgrounds in computer science but have sort of no understanding of you know, the mathematical finance models. And then the quants have come in with backgrounds in physics, engineering, math, but have no background necessarily in, you know, for proper software engineering techniques, or no background or a limited background in parallel computing. And then those two groups internally within the bank just don't seem to talk very well to each other. I think there's some great challenges there for senior management to try to somehow get the two to mesh together. And you know, banks who successfully bridge that gap, you know, could do very well. So. Yeah, I don't know. I guess my impression was it wasn't coming out of the IT side. You know, I think it was senior management seeing, you know, common needs across the different product desks, and also the need to have some amount of people also doing sort of foresight research, and that you could only in a sense justify the research as part of a central group rather than, you know, if everyone's split up in ones and twos, you know, it's harder for any one person to have time to do some research looking ahead. But I don't know. I mean, I'm really not close enough to that situation to, you know, to say with any and that accuracy at all.
Any questions? Allow me to raise the issue we talked about lunch. So those of us who've been around for a while, it's distracting me from you. It's the exact same problem we faced in a program named Cray 1, 1980, was my first job. And in floating point systems machines, same idea, small cheap blocks you stick on your main processor, did vector processing. We all spent a few years programming these things, and eventually we threw it all away because the software maintenance issues. There weren't the appropriate kind of tools that could do automatic translation to something low level. And the software became so nightmarish to maintain that people just gave up on it. So why won't this happen again?
But of course it might, but so a couple of different reasons. So one is that, you know, FPS, this one that we both have knowledge or experience of from years gone past, was a product developed purely for the sort of high performance computing market, and particularly the academic market. Although I guess it also did okay in industrial, but it certainly wasn't a sort of commodity processor. Whereas these GPUs have been driven by a commodity market, and so there's, you know, there's all the billions of revenue that sort of sustains that development. The other thing is, you know, one of the things that did for the GPUs was the fact that, did for FPS, was the fact that the mainstream CPUs just got faster and faster by just turning up the clock speed. Well, now the CPUs have hit this brick wall. So the CPUs, you know, the mainstream is also having to go into this vector computing mode and multi-core mode, and so there isn't the easy alternative. You know, there just isn't any easy way forward. You know, and so I don't think the GPU side's any worse than the CPU side. But it is amusing that, you know, some of this is going back to algorithms and techniques which were, you know, last used sort of 20 years ago, and so having the gray hairs really helps in this area. You remember these algorithms from the first time round, whereas, you know, people who are sort of just coming out of sort of their computer science undergrad degrees, you know, think this is all, you know, a brave new world, and they just don't realize the extent to which it is just come full circle.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
that Mike there? I guess we're going to take a break at 3:30, and KDCD will be talking to